Her eyes took a long moment to adjust. Everything was confused. Walls and ceilings and floor were all the same. She had no sense of direction. "Rojan," she called dizzily. "Where are you?" The lounge seemed empty, but maybe it was only the light or her sense of unease. "Follow the sound," Daniel suggested. He hung in the door, peering warily about for a minute, and then began to feel his way cautiously down a wall, groping with his hands. As if in response to his comment, the sobbing sounds grew suddenly louder, but they seemed to come first from one corner of the room, then from another. Lindgren, impatient, propelled herself across the chamber, searching. She brushed against a wall in the kitchen area, and that made her think of weapons and Daniel's fears. She knew where the utensils were stored. "Here," she said a moment later, turning towards him. "Here, I've got a knife. That should thrill you." She flourished it and brushed against a floating bubble of liquid as big as her fist. It burst and reformed into 100 smaller globules. One moved past her face, close, and she tasted it. Blood. But Lassimer had been dead a long time. His blood ought to have dried by now, she thought. "Oh, merciful God," said Daniel. "What?" Lindgren demanded. "Did you find him?" Daniel was fumbling his way back towards the door, creeping along the wall like an oversized insect, back the way he had come. "Get out, Lindgren," he warned. "Hurry." "Why?" she trembled despite herself. "What's wrong?" "The screams," he said. "The wall, Lindgren, the wall. The sounds." "You're not making any sense," she snapped. "Get a hold of yourself." He gibbered. "Don't you see? The sounds are coming from the wall. The communicator. Faked. Simulated." Daniel reached the door and dove through it, sighing audibly. He did not wait for her. He bolted down the corridor and was gone, pulling himself hand over hand wildly, his feet thrashing and kicking behind him. Lindgren braced herself and moved to follow. The sounds came from in front of her, from the door. "Help me," it said in Rojan Christophorus's voice. She heard moaning and that terrible wet choking sound, and she stopped. From her side came a wheezing, ghastly death rattle. It moaned loudly, building in a counterpoint to the other noise. "Help me. Help me. Help me. Help me," said Christophorus from the darkness behind her. Coughing and a weak groan sounded under her feet. "Help me," all the voices chorused. "Help me. Help me. Help me." Recordings, she thought, recordings being played back. "Help me, help me, help me, help me." All the voices rose higher and louder, and the words turned into a scream, and the scream ended in wet choking, in wheezes and gasps and death. Then the sounds stopped. Just like that, turned off. Lindgren kicked off, floated towards the door, knife in hand. Something dark and silent crawled from beneath the dinner table and rose to block her path. She saw it clearly for a moment as it emerged between her and the light. Rojan Christophorus, still in his vacuum suit, but with the helmet pulled off. He had something in his hand that he raised to point at her. It was a laser. Lindgren saw. A simple cutting laser. She was moving straight towards him, coasting, helpless. She flailed and tried to stop herself, but she could not. When she got quite close, she saw that Rojan had a second mouth below his chin, a long blackened slash, and it was grinning at her, and little droplets of blood flew from it, wetly, as he moved. Daniel rushed down the corridor in a frenzy of fear, bruising himself as he smashed off the walls and doorways. Panic and weightlessness made him clumsy. He kept glancing over his shoulder as he fled, hoping to see Lindgren coming after him, but terrified of what he might see in her stead. Every time he looked back, he lost his sense of balance and went tumbling again. It took a long, long time for the airlock to open. As he waited, trembling, his pulse began to slow. The sounds had dwindled behind him, and there was no sign of pursuit. He steadied himself with an effort. Once inside the locked chamber, with the inner door sealed between him and the lounge, he began to feel safe. Suddenly, Dan'l could barely remember why he had been so terrified. And he was ashamed. He had run, abandoned Lindgren. And for what? What had frightened him so? An empty lounge? Noises from the walls? A rational explanation for that forced itself on him all at once. It only meant that poor Christophorus was somewhere else in the ship, that's all, just somewhere else, alive and in pain, spilling his agony into a comm unit. Dan'l shook his head ruefully. He'd hear no end of this, he knew. Lindgren liked to taunt him. She would never let him forget it. But at least he would return and apologize. That would count for something. Resolute, he reached out and killed the cycle on the airlock, then reversed it. The air that had been partially sucked out came gusting back into the chamber. As the inner door rolled back, Dan'l felt his fear return briefly, an instant of stark terror when he wondered what might have emerged from the lounge to wait for him in the corridors of the night flyer. He faced the fear and willed it away. He felt strong. When he stepped out, Lindgren was waiting. He could see neither anger nor disdain in her curiously calm features, but he pushed himself towards her and tried to frame a plea for forgiveness anyway. I don't know why I... With languid grace, her hand came out from behind her back. The knife flashed up in a killing arc, and that was when Dan'l finally noticed the hole burned in her suit, still smoking, just between her breasts. Your mother? Melantha Drill said incredulously as they hung helpless in the emptiness beyond the ship. She can hear everything we say, Royd replied, but at this point it no longer makes any difference. Rojan must have done something very foolish, very threatening. Now she is determined to kill you all.
She?
What do you mean? Debrannon's voice was puzzled.
Royd, surely you do not tell us that your mother is still alive. You said she died even before you were born.
She did, Crowley, Royd said. I did not lie to you.
No, Melantha said. I didn't think so. But you did not tell us the whole truth either. Royd nodded.
Mother is dead, but her spirit still lives and animates my night flyer. He sighed. Perhaps it would be more fitting to say her night flyer. My control has been tenuous at best.
Royd, Debrannon said, spirits do not exist. They are not real. There's no survival after death. My Volkrin are more real than any ghost.
I don't believe in ghosts either, said Melantha curtly. Call it what you will, then, Royd said. My term is as good as any. The reality is unchanged by the terminology. My mother, or some part of my mother, lives in the Night Flyer, and she is killing all of you as she has killed others before.
Royd, you do not make sense, Debrannon said.
Quiet, Crowley. Let the captain explain.
Yes, Royd said. The Night Flyer is very, very advanced, you know. Automated, self-repairing, large. It had to be if Mother were to be freed from the necessity of a crew. It was built on Newholm, you will recall. I have never been there, but I understand that Newholm's technology is quite sophisticated. Avalon could not duplicate the ship, I suspect. There are few worlds that could.
The point, Captain?
The point. The point is the computers, Melantha. They had to be extraordinary. They are, believe me, they are. Crystal matrix cores, laser grid data retrieval, full sensory extension, and other features.
Are you trying to tell us that the Night Flyer is an artificial intelligence?
Lami Thorne suspected as much. She was wrong, Royd said. My ship is not an artificial intelligence, not as I understand it, but it is something close. Mother had a capacity for personality impress built in. She filled the central crystal with her own memories, desires, quirks, her loves, and her hates. That was why she could trust the computer with my education, you see. She knew it would raise me as she herself would, had she the patience. She programmed it in certain other ways as well.
And you cannot deprogram, my friend?
Karoli asked. Karoli's voice was despairing. I have tried, Karoli, but I am a weak hand at systems work, and the programs are very complicated, the machines very sophisticated. At least 3 times I have eradicated her, only to have her surface once again. She is a phantom program, and I cannot track her. She comes and goes as she will. A ghost, do you see? Her memories and her personality are so intertwined with the programs that run the Night Flyer that I cannot get rid of her without destroying the central crystal, wiping the entire system. But that would leave me helpless. I could never reprogram, and with the computers down, the entire ship would fail, drivers, life support, everything. I would have to leave the Night Flyer, and that would kill me.
You should have told us, my friend,
Karoli Debranin said. On Avalon, we have many cyberneticists, some very great minds. We might have aided you. We could have provided expert help. Lami Thorn might have helped you.
Karoli, I have had expert help. 2 times, I have brought systems specialists on board. The first one told me what I have just told you, that it was impossible without wiping the programs completely. The second had trained on Newholm. She thought she might be able to help me. Mother killed her.
You are still holding something back, Melantha Girl said. I understand how your cybernetic ghost can open and close airlocks at will and arrange other accidents of that nature. But how do you explain what she did to Tala Lassimer?
Ultimately, I must bear that guilt, Royd replied.
My loneliness led me to a grievous error. I thought I could safeguard you, even with a telepath among you. I have carried other riders safely. I watch them constantly, warn them away from dangerous acts. If Mother attempts to interfere, I countermand her directly from the Master Control Console. That usually works. Not always. Usually. Before this trip, she had keeled only 5 times, and the first 3 died when I was quite young. That was how I learned about her presence in my ship. That party included a telepath, too. I should have known better, Karoli. My hunger for life has doomed you all to death. I overestimated my own abilities and underestimated her fear of exposure. She strikes out when she is threatened, and telepaths are always a threat. They sense her, you see. A malign, looming presence, they tell me, something cool and hostile and inhuman.
Yes, Karoli Debranin said. Yes, that was what Tala said. An alien, he was certain of it.
No doubt she feels alien to a telepath used to the familiar contours of organic minds. Hers is not a human brain, after all. What it is, I cannot say. A complex of crystallized memories, a hellish network of interlocking programs, a meld of circuitry and spirit. Yes, I can understand why she might feel alien.
You still haven't explained how a computer program could explode a man's skull, Melantha said.
You wear the answer between your breasts, Melantha.
My whisper jewel? She said, puzzled. She felt it then, beneath her vacuum suit and her clothing, a touch of cold, a vague hint of eroticism that made her shiver. It was as if his mention had been enough to make the gem come alive.
I was not familiar with whisper jewels until you told me of yours, Royd said, but the principle is the same.
Esper etched, you said.
Then you know that psionic power can be stored. The central core of my computer is resonant crystal, many times larger than your tiny jewel. I think Mother impressed it as she lay dying.
Only an Esper can etch a whisper jewel, Melantha said.
You never asked the why of it, either of you, Royd said. You never asked why Mother hated people so.
She was born gifted, you see. On Avalon, she might have been a class one, tested and trained and honored, her talent nurtured and rewarded. I think she might have been very famous. She might have been stronger than a class one, but perhaps it is only after death that she acquired such power, linked as she is to the Nightflyer. The point is moot. She was not born on Avalon. On Vess, her ability was seen as a curse, something alien and fearful, so they cured her of it. They used drugs and electroshock and hypnotraining that made her violently ill whenever she tried to use her talent. They used other, less savory methods as well. She never lost her power, of course, only the ability to use it effectively, to control it with her conscious mind. It remained part of her, suppressed, erratic, a source of shame and pain, surfacing violently in times of great emotional stress. And half a decade of institutional care almost drove her insane. No wonder she hated people. What was her talent? Telepathy? No. Oh, some rudimentary ability, perhaps. I have read that all Psi talents have several latent abilities in addition to their one developed strength. But Mother could not read minds. She had some empathy, although her cure had twisted it curiously so that the emotion she felt literally sickened her. But her major strength, the talent they took 5 years to shatter and destroy, was techie. Melantha Jurl swore. Of course she hated gravity. Telekinesis under weightlessness is... Yes, Royd finished. Keeping the Nightflyer under gravity tortures me, but it limits Mother. In the silence that followed that comment, each of them looked down the dark cylinder of the drive room. Karoli Debrannon moved awkwardly on his sled. Dano and Lindgren have not returned, he said. They are probably dead, Royd said dispassionately. What will we do then? We must plan. We cannot wait here indefinitely. The first question is what I can do, Royd Eris replied. I have talked freely, you'll note. You deserve to know. We have passed the point where ignorance was a protection. Obviously, things have gone too far. There have been too many deaths, and you have been witness to all of them. Mother cannot allow you to return to Avalon alive.
True, said Melantha. But what shall she do with you? Is your own status in doubt, Captain?
The crux of the problem, Royd admitted. You are still 3 moves ahead, Melantha. I wonder if it will suffice. Your opponent is 4 ahead in this game, and most of your pawns are already captured. I fear checkmate is imminent. Unless I can persuade my opponent's king to desert, no.
She could see Royd's wan smile.
She would probably kill me, too, if I choose to side with you. She does not need me.
Karoli Debrannon was slow to grasp the point. But what else could...
My sled has a laser. Yours do not. I could kill you both right now and thereby earn my way back into the Nightflyer's good graces.
Across the 3 meters that lay between their sleds, Melantha's eyes met Royd's. Her hands rested easily on the thruster controls.
You could try, Captain. Remember, the improved model isn't easy to kill.
I would not kill you, Melantha Jurl, Royd said seriously. I have lived 68 standard years, and I have never lived at all. I am tired, and you tell grand, gorgeous lies.
Will you really touch me?
Yes.
I risk a lot for that touch. Yet in a way, it is no risk at all. If we lose, we will all die together. If we win, well, I shall die anyway when they destroy the Nightflyer. Either that or live as a freak in an orbital hospital. And I would prefer death.
We will build you a new ship, Captain, Melantha promised.
Liar,
Royd replied, but his tone was cheerful.
No matter. I have not had much of a life anyway. Death does not frighten me. If we win, you must tell me about your Volcran once again, Karoli. And you, Melantha, you must play chess with me and find a way to touch me and... and sex with you? She finished, smiling.
If you would, he said quietly.
He shrugged.
Well, Mother has heard all of this. Doubtless she will listen carefully to any plans we might make, so there is no sense making them. Now there is no chance that the control lock will admit me since it is keyed directly into the ship's computer. So we must follow the others through the drive room and enter through the main lock and take what small chances we are given. If I can reach my console and restore gravity, perhaps we can win. If not...
He was interrupted by a low groan. For an instant, Melantha thought the Night Flyer was wailing at them again, and she was surprised that it was so stupid as to try the same tactic twice. Then the groan sounded once more, and in the back of Karoli DeBrannan's sled, the forgotten fourth member of their company struggled against the bonds that held her down. DeBrannan hastened to free her, and Agatha Marie Black tried to rise to her feet and almost floated off the sled until he caught her hand and pulled her back.
"Are you well?" he asked. "Can you hear me? Have you pain?"
Imprisoned beneath a transparent faceplate, wide, frightened eyes flicked rapidly from Karoli to Melantha to Royd, and then to the broken Night Flyer. Melantha wondered whether the woman was insane and started to caution DeBrannan when Marie Black spoke.
"The Falcon," was all she said. "Oh, the Falcon."
Around the mouth of the drive room, the ring of nuclear engines took on a faint glow. Melantha Jurl heard Roy suck in his breath sharply. She gave the thruster controls of her sled a violent twist.
"Hurry," she said loudly. "The Night Flyer is preparing to move."
A third of the way down the long barrel of the drive room, Royd pulled abreast of her, stiff and menacing in his black, bulky armor. Side by side, they sailed past the cylindrical star drives and the cyberwebs. Ahead, dimly lit, was the main airlock and its ghastly sentinel.
"When we reach the lock, jump over to my sled," Royd said. "I want to stay armed and mounted, and the chamber is not large enough for two sleds."
Melantha Jurl risked a quick glance behind her. "Karoli," she called. "Where are you?"
"Outside, my love, my friend," the answer came. "I cannot come. Forgive me."
"We have to stay together."
"No," DeBrannan said. "No, I could not risk it. Not when we are so close. It would be so tragic, so futile, Melantha, to come so close and fail. Death I do not mind, but I must see them first, finally, after all these years."
"My mother is going to move the ship," Royd cut in. "Karoli, you will be left behind, lost."
"I will wait," DeBrannan replied. "My Vulcan come, and I must wait for them."
Then the time for conversation was gone, for the airlock was almost upon them. Both sleds slowed and stopped, and Royd Eris reached out and began the cycle while Melantha Jurl moved to the rear of his huge oval work sled. When the outer door moved aside, they glided through into the lock chamber.
"When the inner door opens, it will begin," Royd told her evenly.
"The permanent furnishings are either built in or welded or bolted into place. But the things that your team brought on board are not. Mother will use those things as weapons. And beware of doors, airlocks, any equipment tied into the Night Flyer's computer. Need I warn you not to unseal your suit?"
"Hardly," she replied.
Royd lowered the sled a little, and its grapplers made a metallic sound as they touched against the floor of the chamber. The inner door hissed open, and Royd applied his thrusters. Inside, Danil and Lindrin waited, swimming in a haze of blood. Danil had been slit from crotch to throat, and his intestines moved like a nest of pale, angry snakes. Lindrin still held the knife. They swam closer, moving with a grace they had never possessed in life. Royd lifted his foremost grapplers and smashed them to the side as he surged forward. Danil caromed off a bulkhead, leaving a wide, wet mark where he struck, and more of his guts came sliding out. Lindrin lost control of the knife. Royd accelerated past them, driving up the corridor through the cloud of blood.
"I'll watch behind,"
Melantha said. She turned and put her back to his. Already the two corpses were safely behind them. The knife was floating uselessly in the air. She started to tell Roy that they were all right when the blade abruptly shifted and came after them, gripped by some invisible force. "Swerve!" she cried. The sled shot wildly to one side. The knife missed by a full meter and glanced ringingly off a bulkhead. But it did not drop. It came at them again. The lounge loomed ahead. Dark.
"The door is too narrow," Royd said. "We will have to abandon..."
As he spoke, they hit. He wedged the sled squarely into the doorframe, and the sudden impact jarred them loose. For a moment, Melantha floated clumsily in the corridor, her head whirling, trying to sort up from down. The knife slashed at her, opening her suit and her shoulder clear through to the bone. She felt sharp pain and the warm flush of bleeding. "Damn!" she shrieked. The knife came around again, spraying droplets of blood. Melantha's hand darted out and caught it. She muttered something under her breath and wrenched the blade free of the hand that had been gripping it. Roy had regained the controls of his sled and seemed intent on some manipulation. Beyond him, in the dimness of the lounge, Melantha glimpsed a dark semi-human form rise into view. "Roy!" she warned. The thing activated its small laser. The pencil beam caught Royd square in the chest. He touched his own firing stud. The sled's heavy-duty laser came alive, a shaft of sudden brilliance. It cindered Christophorus's weapon and burned off his right arm and part of his chest. The beam hung in the air, throbbing and smoked against the far bulkhead. Royd made some adjustments and began cutting a hole. "We'll be through in 5 minutes or less," he said curtly.
"Are you all right?" Melantha asked.
"I'm uninjured," he replied. "My suit is better armored than yours, and his laser was a low-powered toy." Melantha turned her attention back to the corridor. The linguists were pulling themselves toward her, one on each side of the passage, to come at her from two directions at once. She flexed her muscles. Her shoulders stabbed and screamed. Otherwise, she felt strong, almost reckless. "The corpses are coming after us again," she told Royd. "I'm going to take them."
"Is that wise?" he asked. "There are two of them."
"I'm an improved model," Melantha said, "and they're dead." She kicked herself free of the sled and sailed towards Danil in a high, graceful trajectory. He raised his hands to block her. She slapped them aside, bent one arm back and heard it snap, and drove her knife deep into his throat before she realized what a useless gesture that was. Blood oozed from his neck in a spreading cloud, but he continued to flail at her. His teeth snapped grotesquely. Melantha withdrew her blade, seized him, and with all her considerable strength threw him bodily down the corridor. He tumbled, spinning wildly, and vanished into the haze of his own blood. Melantha flew in the opposite direction, revolving lazily. Lindgren's hands caught her from behind. Nails scrabbled against her faceplate until they began to bleed, leaving red streaks on the plastic. Melantha whirled to face her attacker, grabbed a thrashing arm, and flung the woman down the passageway to crash into her struggling companion. The reaction sent her spinning like a top. She spread her arms and stopped herself, dizzy, gulping.
"I'm through," Royd announced.
Melantha turned to see. A smoking meter square opening had been cut through one wall of the lounge. Royd killed the laser, gripped both sides of the doorframe, and pushed himself towards it. A piercing blast of sound drilled through her head. She doubled over in agony. Her tongue flicked out and clicked off the comm. Then, there was blessed silence. In the lounge, it was raining. Kitchen utensils, glasses, and plates, pieces of human bodies all lashed violently across the room and glanced harmlessly off Royd's armored form. Melantha, eager to follow, drew back helplessly. That rain of death would cut her to pieces in her lighter, thinner vacuum suit. Royd reached the far wall and vanished into the secret control section of the ship. She was alone. The night flyer lurched, and sudden acceleration provided a brief semblance of gravity. Melantho was thrown to one side, her injured shoulder smashed painfully against the sled. All up and down the corridor, doors were opening. Danil and Lindgren were moving toward her once again. The Night Flyer was a distant star sparked by its nuclear engines. Blackness and cold enveloped them, and below was the unending emptiness of the Tempter's Veil. But Karoly DeBrannon did not feel afraid. He felt strangely transformed. The void was alive with promise.
"They are coming," he whispered. "Even I, who have no sigh at all, even I can feel it. The Kray story must be so. Even from light years off, they can be sensed. Marvelous!"
Agatha Marige Black seemed small and shrunken.
"The Volkryn," she muttered. "What good can they do us? I hurt. The ship is gone. DeBrannon, my head aches." She made a small, frightened noise. "Talis said that just after I injected him, before... you know. He said that his head hurt. It aches so terribly."
"Quiet, Agatha. Do not be afraid. I am here with you. Wait. Think only of what we shall witness. Think only of that."
"I can sense them," the Sysak said.
DeBrannon was eager.
"Tell me then. We have our little sled. We shall go to them. Direct me."
"Yes," she agreed. "Yes, oh yes."
Gravity returned. In a flicker, the universe became almost normal. Melantha fell to the deck, landed easily and rolled, and was on her feet catquick. The objects that had been floating ominously through the open doors along the corridor all came clattering down. The blood was transformed from fine mist to a slick covering on the corridor floor. The two corpses dropped heavily from the air and lay still. Royd spoke to her from the communicators built into the walls.
"I made it," he said. "I noticed," she replied. "I am at the main control console. I have restored the gravity with a manual override, and I'm cutting off as many computer functions as possible. We're still not safe, though. Mother will try to find a way around me. I'm countermanding her by sheer force, as it were. I cannot afford to overlook anything, and if my attention should lapse, even for a moment..."
"Melantha, was your suit breached?"
"Yes, cut at the shoulder.
Change into another one, immediately. I think the counter-programming I'm doing will keep the locks sealed, but I can't take any chances." Melantha was already running down the corridor toward the cargo hold where the suits and equipment were stored. "When you have changed," Royd continued, "dump the corpses into the mass conversion unit. You'll find the appropriate hatch near the drive room airlock, just to the left of the lock controls. Convert any other loose objects that are not indispensable as well. Scientific instruments, books, tapes, tableware, knives," suggested Melantha.
"By all means."
"Is Techie still a threat, Captain?"
"Mother is vastly weaker in a gravity field," Royd said. "She has to fight it. Even boosted by the Night Flyer's power, she can only move one object at a time, and she has only a fraction of the lifting force she wields under weightless conditions. But the power is still there, remember. Also, it is possible she will find a way to circumvent me and cut out the gravity again. From here, I can restore it in an instant, but I don't want any likely weapons lying around even for that brief period of time." Melantha reached the cargo area. She stripped off her vacuum suit and slipped into another one in record time, wincing at the pain in her shoulder. It was bleeding badly, but she had to ignore it. She gathered up the discarded suit and a double armful of instruments and dumped them into the conversion chamber. Afterward, she turned her attention to the bodies. Danil was no problem. Lindgren crawled down the corridor after her as she pushed him through and thrashed weakly when it was her own turn, a grim reminder that the Night Flyer's powers were not all gone. Melantha easily overcame her feeble struggles and forced her through.
Christophorus's burned, ruined body writhed in her grasp and snapped its teeth at her, but Melantha had no real trouble with it. While she was cleaning out the lounge, a kitchen knife came spinning at her head. It came slowly, though, and Melantha just batted it aside, then picked it up and added it to the pile for conversion. She was working through the cabins, carrying Agatha Marie Black's abandoned drugs and injection gun under her arm, when she heard Royd cry out. A moment later, a force like a giant invisible hand wrapped itself around her chest and squeezed and pulled her, struggling, to the floor. Something was moving across the stars. Dimly and far off, DeBrannon could see it, though he could not yet make out the details. But it was there, that was unmistakable, some vast shape that blocked off a section of the starscape. It was coming at them dead on. How he wished he had his team with him now, his computer, his telepath, his experts, his instruments. He pressed harder on the thrusters and rushed to meet his Vulcan. Pinned to the floor, hurting, Melantha Jurl risked opening her suit's comm. She had to talk to Royd.
"Are you there?" she asked. "What's happening.
The pressure was awful, and it was growing steadily worse. She could barely move. The answer was pained and slow in coming.
"Outwitted me," Royd's voice managed. "Hurts to talk. Royd? She tacked the dial up to G's, three higher, right on the board. All I have to do, turn it back, let me."
Silence. Then finally, when Melantha was near despair, Royd's voice again, one word.
"Can't."
Melantha's chest felt as if it were supporting 10 times her own weight. She could imagine the agony Royd must be in. Royd, for whom even one gravity was painful and dangerous. Even if the dial was an arm's length away, she knew his feeble musculature would never let him reach it.
"Why?"
she started. Talking was not as hard for her as it seemed to be for him.
"Why would she turn up the gravity? It weakens her, too, yes?"
"Yes.
But in a time, hour, minute, my heart will burst, and then you alone, she will kill gravity, kill you."
Painfully, Melantha reached out her arm and dragged herself half the length down the corridor.
"Royd, hold on. I'm coming."
She dragged herself forward again. Agatha's drug kit was still under her arm, impossibly heavy. She eased it down and started to shove it aside. It felt as if it weighed 100 kilos. She reconsidered. Instead, she opened its lid. The ampules were all neatly labeled. She glanced over them quickly, searching for adrenaline or synthestim, anything that might give her the strength she needed to reach Royd. She found several stimulants, selected the strongest, and was loading it into the injection gun with awkward, agonized slowness when her eyes chanced on the supply of Esperon. Melantha did not know why she hesitated. Esperon was only one of a half dozen psionic drugs in the kit, none of which could do her any good, but something about seeing it bothered her, reminded her of something she could not quite lay her finger on. She was trying to sort it out when she heard the noise.
"Royd," she said, "your mother, could she move?" "She couldn't move anything. Techie it in this higher gravity. Could she?"
"Maybe,"
he answered. "If concentrate all her power, hard, maybe possible. Why?
Because, Melanthadrill said grimly,
because something, someone, is cycling through the airlock.
It is not truly a ship. Not as I thought it would be,
Coroli de Brannan was saying. His suit, Academy Design, had a built-in encoding device, and he was recording his comments for posterity, strangely secure in the certainty of his impending death.
The scale of it is difficult to imagine, difficult to estimate. Vast, vast. I have nothing but my wrist computer, no instruments. I cannot make accurate measurements, but I would say, 100 kilometers, perhaps as much as 300 across. Not solid mass, of course, not at all. It is delicate, airy. No ship as we know ships, no city either. It is, beautiful. It is crystal and gossamer, alive with its own dim lights, a vast, intricate kind of spiderwebby craft. It reminds me a bit of the old star sail ships they used once, in the days before drive. But this great construct, it is not silent, it cannot be driven by light. It is no ship at all, really. It is all open to vacuum. It has no sealed cabins or life support spheres, none visible to me, unless blocked from my line of sight in some fashion. And no, I cannot believe that. It is too open, too fragile. It moves quite rapidly. I would wish for the instrumentation to measure its speed, but it is enough to be here. I am taking the sled at right angles to it to get clear of its path, but I cannot say that I will make it. It moves so much faster than we. Not at light speed, no. Far below light speed, but still faster than the Night Flyer and its nuclear engines, I would guess. Only a guess. The Volcran craft has no visible means of propulsion. In fact, I wonder how. Perhaps it is a light sail, laser launch millennia ago, now torn and rotted by some unimaginable catastrophe. But no, it is too symmetrical, too beautiful. The webbings, the great shimmering veils near the nexus, the beauty of it. I must describe it. I must be more accurate. I know. It is difficult. I grow too excited. It is large, as I have said, kilometers across. Roughly. Let me count. Yes. Roughly, octagonal in shape. The nexus, the center, is a bright area. A small darkness surrounded by a much greater area of light, but only the dark portion seems entirely solid. The lighted areas are translucent. I can see stars through them, though discolored, shifted towards the purple. Veils. I call those the veils. From the nexus and the veils, 8 long. Oh, vastly long. Spurs project. Not quite space evenly, so it is not a true geometric octagon. Ah, I see better now. One of the spurs is shifting. Oh, very slowly. The veils are rippling. They are mobile then, those projections, and the webbing runs from one spur to the next, around and around. But there are patterns, odd patterns. It is not at all the simple webbing of a spider. I cannot quite see order in the patterns, in the traceries of the webs, but I feel sure the order is there. The meaning is waiting to be found. There are lights. Have I mentioned the lights? The lights are brightest around the center nexus, but they are nowhere very bright. A dim violet. Some visible radiation then, but not much. I would like to take an ultraviolet reading of this craft, but I do not have the instrumentation. The lights move. The veils seem to ripple and lights run constantly up and down the lengths of the spurs at differing rates of speed, and sometimes other lights can be seen transversing the webbing, moving across the patterns. I do not know what the lights are. Some form of communication, perhaps. I cannot tell whether they emanate from inside the craft or outside. There was another light just then. Between the spurs, a brief flash, a starburst. It is gone now already. It was more intense than the others, indigo. I feel so helpless, so ignorant. But they are beautiful, my Volcran.
The myths. This is really not much like the legends, not truly. The sighs, the lights. The Vorkryn have often been linked to lights, but those reports were so vague, they might have meant anything, described anything from a laser propulsion system to simple exterior lighting. I could not know it meant this. Ah, what mystery! The ship is still too far away to see the finer detail. It is so large, I do not think we shall get clear of it. It seems to have turned towards us, I think, yet I may be mistaken. It is only an impression. My instruments, if only I had my instruments. Perhaps the darker area in the center is a craft, a life capsule. The Vorkryn must be inside it. I wish my team were with me. And Tala. Poor Tala. He was a Class 1. We might have made contact, might have communicated with them. The things we would learn, the things they have seen. To think how old this craft is, how ancient the race, how long they have been outbound. It fills me with awe. Communication would be such a gift, such an impossible gift. But they are so alien.
DeBrannon, Agatha Marie Black said in a low, urgent voice, can't you feel?
Karoli DeBrannon looked at her as if seeing her for the first time.
Can you feel them? You are a 3. Can you sense them now, strongly?
Long ago, the Psi-Psych said. Long ago.
Can you project? Talk to them, Agatha? Where are they? In the center area? The dark?
Yes, she replied, and she laughed. Her laugh was shrill and hysterical, and DeBrannon had to recall that she was a very sick woman.
Yes, in the center, DeBrannon. That's where the pulses come from. Only you're wrong about them. It's not a them at all.
Your legends are all lies, lies. I wouldn't be surprised if we were the first ever to see your Vorkryn to come this close.
The others, those aliens of yours, they merely felt, deep and distantly, sensed a bit of the nature of the Vorkryn in their dreams and visions, and fashioned the rest to suit themselves.
Ships and wars and a race of eternal travelers. It is all. All.
Yes? What do you mean, Agatha, my friend? You do not make sense. I do not understand.
No, Marie Black said. You do not, do you?
Her voice was suddenly gentle.
You cannot feel it as I can. So clear now. This must be how a 1... feels all the time. A 1 full of Esperon.
What do you feel? What?
It's not a them, Karoli. It's an it. Alive, Karoli, and quite mindless, I assure you.
Mindless? DeBrannon said.
No, you must be wrong. You are not reading correctly. I will accept that it is a single creature if you say so. A single great, marvelous star traveler. But how can it be mindless?
You sensed it. It's mine. It's telepathic emanations. You and the whole of the Kray sensitives and all the others. Perhaps its thoughts are too alien for you to read.
Perhaps. But what I do read is not so terribly alien at all. Only animal. His thoughts are slow and dark and strange, hardly thoughts at all, faint, stirrings cold and distant. The brain must be huge, all right. I grant you that, but it can't be devoted to conscious thought.
What do you mean?
The propulsion system, DeBrannon. Don't you feel the pulses? They are threatening to rip off the top of my skull.
Can't you guess what is driving your damn Vorkryn across the galaxy and why they avoid gravity wells? Can't you guess how it is moving?
No, DeBrannon said, but even as he denied it, a dawn of comprehension broke across his face, and he looked away from his companion, back at the swelling immensity of the Vorkryn, its lights moving, its veils a ripple as it came on and on, across light years, light centuries, across eons. When he looked back at her, he mouthed only a single word.
Teki, he said.
She nodded.
Melantha Jurl struggled to lift the injection gun and press it against an artery. It gave a single loud hiss and the drug flooded her system. She lay back and gathered her strength and tried to think. Esperon, why was that important? It had killed Lassimer, made him a victim of his own latent abilities, multiplied his power and his vulnerability. Sigh. It all came back to Sigh. The inner door of the airlock opened. The headless corpse came through. It moved with jerks, unnatural shufflings, never lifting its legs from the floor. It sagged as it moved, half-crushed by the weight upon it. Each shuffle was crude and sudden. Some grim force was literally yanking one leg forward, then the next. It moved in slow motion, arms stiff by its sides. But it moved. Melantha summoned her own reserves and began to squirm away from it, never taking her eyes off its advance. Her thoughts went round and round, searching for the piece out of place, the solution to the chess problem, finding nothing. The corpse was moving faster than she was. Clearly, visibly, it was gaining. Melantha tried to stand. She got to her knees with a grunt, her heart pounding. Then one knee. She tried to force herself up, to lift the impossible burden on her shoulders as if she were lifting weights. She was strong, she told herself. She was the improved model. But when she put all her weight on one leg, her muscles would not hold her. She collapsed awkwardly, and when she smashed against the floor, it was as if she had fallen from a building. She heard a sharp snap, and a stab of agony flashed up her arm. Her good arm, the arm she had tried to use to break her fall. The pain in her shoulder was terrible and intense. She blinked back tears and choked on her own scream. The corpse was halfway up the corridor. It must be walking on two broken legs, she realized. It didn't care. A force greater than tendons and bone and muscle was holding it up.
Melantha, I heard you. Are you Melantha?
Quiet, she snarled at Royd. She had no breath to waste on talk. Now she used all the discipline she had ever learned, willed away the pain. She kicked feebly, her boots scraping for purchase, and she pulled herself forward with her unbroken arm, ignoring the fire in her shoulder. The corpse came on and on. She dragged herself across the threshold of the lounge, worming her way under the crashed sled, hoping it would delay the cadaver. The thing that had been Tala Lassimer was a meter behind her. In the darkness in the lounge, where it had all begun, Melantha Jurl ran out of strength. Her body shuddered and she collapsed on the damp carpet, and she knew that she could go no further. On the far side of the door, the corpse stood stiffly. The sled began to shake. Then, with the scrape of metal against metal, it slid backwards, moving in tiny sudden increments, jerking itself free and out of the way. Sigh. Melantha wanted to curse it and cry. Vainly, she wished for a psi power of her own, a weapon to blast apart the techie-driven corpse that stalked her. She was improved, she thought despairingly, but not improved enough. Her parents had given her all the genetic gifts they could arrange, but psi was beyond them. The genes were astronomically rare, recessive, and suddenly, it came to her. Royd, she said, putting all of her remaining will into her words. She was weeping, wet, frightened. The dial. Techie it. Royd, techie it. His reply was faint, troubled.
Gant. I don't, mother. Only her. Not me. No. Mother.
Not mother, she said desperate. You always say mother.
I forgot. Forgot. Not your mother. Listen. You're a clone. Same genes. You have it too. Power.
Don't, he said. Never. Must be sex-linked. No, it isn't. I know. Promethean. Royd. Don't tell a Promethean about genes. Turn it.
The sled jumped a third of a meter and listed to the side. A path was clear. The corpse came forward.
Trying, Royd said. Nothing. I can't. She cured you,
Melantha said bitterly.
Better than she was cured. Prenatal. But it's only suppressed. You can. I don't know how.
The corpse stood above her, stopped. Its pale fleshed hands trembled, spasmed, jerked upward. Long painted fingernails, made claws, began to rise. Melantha swore,
Royd! Sorry.
She wept and shook and made a futile fist. And all at once the gravity was gone. Far, far away, she heard Royd cry out and then fall silent.
The flashes come more frequently now, Karoli Debranen dictated. Or perhaps it is simply that I am closer, that I can see them better. Bursts of indigo and deep violet, short and fast fading. Between the webbing, a field, I think. The flashes are particles of hydrogen, the thin, ethereal stuff of the reaches between the stars. They touch the field between the webbing, the spurs, and shortly flare into the range of visible light. Matter to energy, yes. That is what I guess. My Vulcan feeds. It feels half the universe comes on and on. We shall not escape it. Oh, so sad. Agatha is gone. Silent. Blood on her faceplate. I can almost see the dark area. Almost, almost. I have a strange vision. In the center is a face, small, rat-like, without a mouth or nose or eyes, yet still a face somehow, and it stares at me. The veils move so sensuously, the webbing looms around us. Ah, the light! The light!
The corpse bobbed awkwardly into the air, its hands hanging limply before it. Melantha, reeling in the weightlessness, was suddenly violently sick. She ripped off the helmet, collapsed it, and pushed away from her own nausea, trying to ready herself for the Night Flyer's furious assault. But the body of Tala Lassimer floated dead and still, and nothing else moved in the darkened lounge. Finally, Melantha recovered, and she moved to the corpse, weakly, and pushed it a small and tentative shove. It sailed across the room. Royd? She said uncertainly. There was no answer. She pulled herself through the hole into the control chamber and found Royd Eris suspended in his armored suit. She shook him, but he did not stir. Trembling, Melantha Drill studied his suit and then began to dismantle it. She touched him. Royd, she said.
Here. Feel, Royd. Here. I'm here. Feel it.
His suit came apart easily, and she flung the pieces of it away.
Royd? Royd.
Dead. Dead. His heart had given out. She punched it, pommeled it, tried to pound it into new life. It did not beat. Dead. Dead. Melantha Jarl moved back from him. Blinded by her own tears, edged into the console, glanced down. Dead. Dead. But the dial on the gravity grid was set on zero. Melantha, said a mellow voice from the walls. I have held the Night Flyer's crystalline soul within my hands. It is deep red and multifaceted, large as my head, and icy to the touch.
In its scarlet depths, two small sparks of smoky light burn fiercely, and sometimes